Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and we are delighted to welcome you all here, and particularly to welcome Ambassador Amorim to the school. Indeed, I should say to welcome him back to the school, because, in fact, he was a student here from 1968 to 1971. And this morning he made a shameful confession that he did not finish his PhD, which has probably cost us money because we get penalised for PhD students who don't complete.
Because I had to finance my own studies.
But he was, of course, working in the embassy, Brazilian embassy here at the time, at the same time, so I guess can be excused for putting his career above his academic work. But, of course, since then, we hope in part due to his experience here at the LSE, he's had a hugely distinguished career in the Brazilian Foreign Service and, of course, in politics more recently, and has been the Minister of Foreign Affairs in the Lula government since 2003. As you will all know, the Brazilian president has been here on a state visit this week. The state visit is officially over, but fortunately for us, there are some other events arranged in the margin of that visit, and this is one of them. The central issue during this week's discussions, certainly if one believes the press, has been the progress of the WTO talks. There are ministerial meetings going on this week around the state visit, and it would appear from the joint declaration between Tony Blair and President Lula that there was a reasonable degree of meeting of minds between the British and Brazilian governments on these issues. But Ambassador Amorim is far better qualified than I to explain all that, and he's going to talk to us this morning specifically about the current state of the WTO negotiations. We will then have time for questions, but we must wind up at about 11:15 because he needs to talk to the press as well before leaving at 12. So I will bias my questions in the question and answer session away from the members of the press, but you'll have your chance immediately afterwards. But with that brief introduction, let me introduce Ambassador Amorim. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Davis. It is a pleasure being here, seeing some of my friends that I have met in London before, and some, of course, of my Brazilian friends as well. I don't know if I have anything like an alma mater, because, as I told you, I had never finished my PhD. That was probably because of an excess of ambition at the time, and I don't want to stress that too much, because it may have a wrong reading when we're dealing about with the door around. But anyway, I'll explain that later. But I just make one little comment, because I did do some work here with Professor Miliband at the time. I actually was originally registered for an MPhil. I don't know if that exists any longer. But at the middle of the process, he said that my thesis was of doctoral standard, which was very flattering to me. But the academic times and the bureaucratic times didn't fit together. So I was transferred from London before I was able to finish. Maybe if I had stayed with the MPhil, I would have finished. But later on, when I came to Brazil, I found many people that had the title PhD ABD, which I thought it was probably something very important, more than a PhD. Then I discovered that was, I don't know if it was a Brazilian invention or it was an American invention, but it meant PhD all but dissertation. So I fell more or less in that category. But because in England the PhD was basically the dissertation, if I would put PhD ABD, it means nothing. So I just want to assure you that I did some work, but I didn't finish it. Anyway, I hope I can finish the door around, though. Let me help to finish. Let me just say, first of all, that I'm very much pleased to be here, and I think this is certainly the appropriate audience, not only to transmit some of what I think, but probably to get some feedback also on important aspects of these negotiations. And I would like to start, if I may, before going into these technical details, by somehow presenting the view of the Brazilian government, President Lula's government, in relation to the round. And I think this is important to put in context, because we saw in The Economist last week this piece, Lula's World. And I think it is important to see how the round fits into Lula's world, so to say. When we think about that, and I will come back to the joint declaration that you mentioned, because I think it is indeed an important milestone, I would say, in terms of two leaders speaking about the round at this stage. But before I'm going to that, I would like to say that for us, and especially for President Lula, the round is not about trade alone. It's about trade for development, and it's also to make sure that the result of the round is not only to make it possible to have some immediate gains in this or that area in which we are more competitive. Certainly we are interested in that as well, but it must be something that has at least two consequences, important consequences. One is that it would reinforce the multilateral system. I think this is a very important thing for Brazil. It's a very important thing for the UK, I'm sure, and for all those that want a world which has a better governance. So I think this is an essential element of our effort. And the second point, it's not dissociated from the first, is that it must also be around that brings that bears fruit for developing countries, but especially for the poorest countries. And President Lula has been stressing that very often. And some people might think it's I'll go deeper into that later on. That it must be that maybe lip service or something like that. That Brazil is only looking at its own very competitive agriculture, not looking to Africa or Caribbean countries or other poorer countries. But I can tell you that's not true. And if you want to have evidence of that attitude, of this real concern for the poorest countries, well, first you can see there is a paragraph in the joint statement that deals precisely with this question of quota-free, duty-free, for the poorest countries, for the LDCs, and Brazil is committed to do that, of course, in proportion to our means, which are not the same as the one of Europe or the US, but we are committed to do that. But you could also look at these agreements that have been recently signed by some Andean countries. And if you compare the agreements that were signed by Brazil, or Mercosur for that matter, with Colombia and Peru, and Ecuador, and you compare these agreements to the TLCs that have been just signed with the United States, you will see that although the level of development between Brazil and Colombia or Brazil and Ecuador is not that big, we have been much more, respondent to the sensitivities of this country. Of these countries than it was the case in the TLC, as far as my analysis goes. I mean, these agreements are rather recent. But I think this is quite surprising that Brazil, which has, and for that matter, the other countries of Mercosur that are involved, but in different degrees because we made some differences, that Brazil would accept some sort of S&D for a special and differential treatment for the poor, for the countries that were in a lower level of development, and the big country, the most developed one, didn't do that at the same, at least in the same dimension, same scale. But let me go now to the subject of my talk here, which is the current status of the WTO negotiations. I I want to go as quickly as possible to the current status, but I think it's very difficult to do that without at least some background. And the first point that I think one should note when we speak about the Doha development round, and it's something the first thing that should strike the eye, so to say, is the word development itself. Because if you go back to the history of the GATT, and even the beginning of the history of the WTO, you'll find that development was almost anathema. You know, and when I was ambassador there in the end of the Uruguay round, and I had to deal with these questions several times. Actually, I signed as minister in my previous incarnation the Marrakesh Agreement, which I don't know if it's something that I'm proud or not, but I think it was the right thing to do at the time, because being outside would be worse. But development was almost, as I say, an anathema. I mean, this was a theme for the United Nations, for UNCTAD, not for serious people that were dealing with trade. Trade was trade. And that's what we should be looking at the GATT, old GATT, and in the WTO. So the simple fact, of course, there had been in the past enabling clause, or there have been some lip service to development, but it was only marginal. It was always the exception in the negotiation, not really an objective of the negotiation. Maybe it's because the philosophy behind that was that development would be an automatic consequence of trade liberalization. Maybe it was some other reason. It doesn't really, I don't want to go into that now. But in any case, it was never at the center of the preoccupations that we had. Actually, when UNCTAD was created back in the 60s, early 60s, it was a kind of second best, because we could not make the World Trade Organization a World Trade and Development Organization, so we created UNCTAD. But of course, UNCTAD was very useful, and it was helpful in producing studies and in other aspects, but it was, of course, a powerless organization, nothing compared to the GATT or to the WTO. And also, I think, because in these previous rounds, from the beginning until the Tokyo round, the old GATT was about north-north trade. I mean, the developing countries only were some kind of afterthought. And, I mean, if they would win something, fine. If they wouldn't win, also fine. But they had not much to give, and they would not have much to ask for. Well, they had quite a lot to ask for, but they didn't have the power to ask for. So this is more or less how it operated until the Uruguay round. And I don't want to go deeply into the Uruguay round because it's a long story and I don't want to go there. But in the Uruguay round, it started to be north-south. But it was only now north-south. It was not south-north. So there was a lot of the demands that were put by the developed countries in terms of services, intellectual property, in terms of, for instance, binding and sealing bindings for our tariffs. I just give the example of Brazil. Brazil, even during the Uruguay round, we had 2,000 to 3,000 products that were accepted from any kind of tariff treatment. They had non-tariff barriers. They were subject to prior license, and the prior license would never appear if you had a similar production in Brazil. Then we moved a little further, but the tariffs, for instance, for automobile, I remember, was 105 or something like that. So the Uruguay round was about opening market for services, creating links between the intellectual property rights system, which until then had been the object of another organization, the WIPO, and also about reducing and binding the tariffs of developing countries. And that's why at that time Brazil, for instance, and the other Mercosur countries took the commitment to bind the tariffs at a level of 35% for industrial goods. But why do I mention that? Because I think this is very important, and we may have to come back to that at some point. I don't know the question and answer, because very often I hear the complaint, or not really the complaint, but the remark. I heard it recently in Davos, that, well, business is not so interested now as it was. Well, of course, when people say business, they're speaking of business in developed countries, because nobody's minding about business in developing countries. So business is not so interested in this round as it was in the Uruguay round. And it's quite understandable, because first, the trade among the developed countries is very much liberalized already. And the opening up of the markets of developing countries was basically done, it basically took place in the Uruguay round. So I had the opportunity, I'll come back to that later, but I had the opportunity to ask that, well, I challenge anyone in this room, anyone who owns a company, a telephone company or a bank, to say that they had a difficulty in establishing itself in Brazil. So maybe the rules are not yet maybe bound and consolidated at a perfect level, but the truth is that, or water services or retail trade for that matter. So the huge push to liberalize developing countries had already taken place. So Uruguay round was basically, as I said, a north-south thing. Also, other things take place in the same time, of course, and I would not underestimate the beginning of disciplines in the agricultural trade. It was only beginning, but it was important, and I think the fact that it was important can be illustrated by two very important cases that we brought to the WTO, against the United States, the other one against Europe. Quite daring, I would say, to bring the two at the same time, but you know, Brazilians are a bit maybe sometimes optimistic. We brought two cases, one on cotton against the U.S. and one on sugar against the European Union, and we won both. And of course, we won both based on the rules that existed in the Uruguay round. So I can't say it was totally useless, although nobody thought, actually, when the Uruguay round finished, that that would be the case. But with good lawyers and political will and courage, we were able to do that. When I say lawyers, I also refer to people who have been dealing with legal questions and dispute settlement questions inside our foreign ministry, not only hired lawyers. So that was something that happened, but it was very insufficient in agriculture and universally considered as insufficient. And that's why, at the end of the Uruguay round, the negotiators agreed that there should be what was then called a built-in agenda or mandated negotiations, and agriculture should be one of the areas, the other was services, in which mandated negotiations should take place, because there was the recognition that what was done in agriculture was very little compared, I mean, just compared to tariffs. I mean, when people say nowadays, Brazil or India, they have to reduce the tariffs. Well, speaking for Brazil, our maximum tariff in industry is 35. The maximum tariff in agriculture in the European Union is around 200, I believe, and in Japan is 1,000. So these kind of proportionalities have to be considered when we discuss what we can and we cannot do in this round. But, of course, everybody agreed that not to speak about subsidies. In industry, all subsidies, is it illegal? As I said once recently in a Davos forum, if we did in industry what the Europe and the U.S., or Japan for that matter, do in agriculture, in subsidies on agriculture, if I did that same kind of thing in subsidies in industry, I would not only face the WTO, I would probably be in jail. Because, you know, it's so absurd, the difference, that one cannot even put a comparison there. I mean, of course, as you know, we as Brazil also have faced challenges, and we have also challenged other countries in the area of subsidies in industry, most notably on airplanes, which I think it's important to keep things in perspective, not to think that, for instance, Brazil is only interested in agriculture, but we focus so much on agriculture because it lagged so much behind. But we are also interested in other subjects as well. So that was it. We had to move on agriculture. That's what we had to do. And that's why, at the time, Sir Leon Britton, I think, and then Lord Britton, devised very intelligently this idea of the Millennium Round. I don't know if anyone still remembers the Millennium Round, but that was how it was used to be called before Seattle. Maybe the name was too presumptuous, and that maybe it's good that we just left it behind, but that is how it was called. And what was the Millennium Round? Essentially, in my opinion, it was a way first to recognize that agriculture had to go ahead, but political conditions were not given in developed countries to do agriculture alone, or even to do agriculture and services alone, that they needed many more, how should I put it, paraphernalia around that, so that you could sell the round for the public opinion here in Europe. That was what it was basically about. And then, of course, you may remember, there are now, fortunately, gone, all these, and I'm not speaking because of Brazil, but because of countries that are poorer and more vulnerable than ourselves, there are all these Singapore issues. Remember the Singapore issues? All gone. They're all gone because they were totally unrealistic. These included investment, government procurement, and so on. But this is what we discussed in Seattle. Don't want to go back to Seattle, big failure. Then we continue discussing all these subjects. And then I would say there was one particular factor which had a big impact, is the awareness that the world could not accept and could not live with a situation in which the multilateral system would break down. And I think probably what brought that more light into that was September 11. And of course, in a situation in which the world was suffering from terrorism and many other threats, it would be unaffordable to have a situation in which the real linchpin of the economic trade would just crumble down. And I think partly because of that, partly because also the negotiators had worked hard for about 2 years, it was possible to launch the Doha Round. And the Doha Round got this nice title for the first time, as I said, which is the Doha Development Round. So there was, in a way, a recognition that it was not good enough to have a purely trade liberalization. It had to be trade liberalization that would help development. This, as much as possible, would be kept, I would say, as some sort of lip service, or maybe some special effort for LDCs, maybe, but not go into the mainstream. How was the development dimension, in my opinion, expressed in Doha? And I think there are other aspects that I can't go deeply into them now, don't have time for that. But one of them was immediate. It was in the Doha Declaration itself, was the Declaration on Trips and Health. That was a very important thing that opened the way for making sure that developing countries were able to have resort to compulsory licensing, for instance, in cases like HIV/AIDS or any serious disease for that matter. Of course, they could do that they could do that and still be complying with the TRIPS agreement. So that was an important political interpretation, but surely with legal consequences of the Doha Round that was immediate. And the other thing, basically, was agriculture. Then there are lots of other, I would not say smaller, but let us say less central things, like provisions on S&D treatment, provisions on the famous area of implementation that we still have to fight for, which were several demands of developing countries. But agriculture, of course, was central for the reasons I have given you and for the obvious reasons that most developing countries have a competitive edge in agriculture. And so they either are already very competitive, it's the case of Brazil, it's the case of Argentina, it's the case of Uruguay, it's the case of Chile, or they may become competitive if the subsidies are taken away. It's an interesting fact because when people think it's only countries like Brazil or Argentina in the developing world that would gain with the liberalization of agriculture, you know, you have to look at the potential. I mean, I reply with that, because take the case of cotton. Brazil has become very, but when I was a young boy in school, Brazil no longer was a producer of cotton. We had been put out of the market of cotton. I didn't know why. Well, now I understand. But 15 years ago, if you say, well, having an agreement on agriculture is important for Brazil because of cotton. I said, well, Brazil doesn't export cotton. We import cotton. But of course it was important because we were unable to export because of the subsidies. So it was really, the same situation now applies to some African countries. And I'll come back to that again. I'm sorry making these anticipations. But so agriculture being in the center of the round, we went to Cancun. Cancun had many other aspects. There are all these Singapore issues that were fortunately left aside then, and that's what, for those who really accompanied the negotiations, was really the moment in which the negotiations broke down in Cancun. But there was a very important thing that I would not hesitate calling a revolution. It was the G20 revolution. I think this, I mean, I've dealt with the WTO for a long time and with the GATT before. In the GATT, we used to have the, and it had to be called that way, because otherwise it would be considered a major sin. It was the informal group of developing countries. You could not even call the group of developing countries because that would sound too much UNCTAD-ish. So in order not to sound UNCTAD-ish, we had to call the informal group of developing countries. We had attempts of making common cause before, but they were very difficult, not only because those interests were not obvious, always the same, and there was a great difference, a great difficulty in looking into the common interest beyond the immediate interest. So, and this is still true to some extent, and that's why it was easier for some of the developed countries to try to divide the developing countries. Well, Brazil is a big agricultural producer, so this side, Zambia is an LDC, that side, and so on and so forth. So I think in Cancun we had, in a way, the G20 revolution, I would say. And why? And because for the first time, I think it was possible to create a group of developing countries that work together, not only, or not mainly, I would say, or maybe even not at all, with defensive preoccupations, but with a real forward-looking, propositive, if I could say, use that word, blueprint. And this was, of course, the liberalization in agriculture centered in on the question of the subsidies and market access in the rich markets. But even then, even in Cancun, this was still demonized. And I still remember not only the we had to fight not only in the rooms but also in the media to make our case. And I still remember my good friend, can't say it. I'm true, I'm not being ironic or anything like that. My good friend Bob Zelik, about 1 week or 2 weeks later after Cancun, writing an article about, I think he used to say, the ones who want and the ones that don't want, but he did that with an expression that I can't remember now. Of course, leading those who didn't want was Brazil. So we had the honor in an article of the Financial Times, not very big article, that the name of Brazil was mentioned 5 times, not very flat, not a very flattering way, I would say, by Bob Zelik. Well, that changed in a dramatic way in the space of 6 months, because, and now I have, as I always do, I have to pay tribute to Pascal Lamy, because it was really and the pressure was immense on the G20, and some countries of Latin America starting to just abandon the G20 because, of course, they were under very strong pressure if they were interested in a TLC with the United States and so on. So some of them got off the G20. Some came back later on. Some didn't come back formally, but followed the G20 now somehow. But that was the fact. And in the space of less than 6 months, well, I think 4 months, Cancun was, August, I don't remember exactly, but anyway, 4 months, the situation changed. We organized a meeting of G20 in Brasilia, and we invited Pascal Lamy And Pascal Amy did come. And that was, it somehow helped to show that the G20 was a major actor in and one without which it would be impossible to conclude the round. Well, one month later, I got a phone call by Bob Zelig himself, and he said, well, you have to do something, and so on. And I said, well, but I can't do anything without the G20. And he was a bit reluctant to mention the G20 as such, but he said, no, I'm ready to talk to whoever it is. So this was, let us say, if you wish, the legitimizing or re-legitimizing of the G20 on the part of the developed world. And I think that enabled us to go through the framework agreement in July 2004, which was some progress. You may remember that, for instance, I just mentioned one crucial issue in the Doha development agenda. The reference to export subsidies was still reduced with a view to phasing out. I mean, some kind of language that, of course, with the imagination that always develops in Brussels or elsewhere, you never know exactly how you read it and how it should be. So in the 2004, we had a clear reference to elimination by an end date of export subsidies. So this was a progress. There were other areas also in which we made progress, but I just mentioned this one. And then we came to, not much progress was made after this, the framework agreement, to be quite honest, except for the fact that the G20 continued to produce its proposals. And its proposals were seen very often. There were ambitious proposals, I think, but at the same time, they were middle of the road between what the U.S. was demanding and what the European Union was prepared to do in the area of agriculture. And we were able to develop some of these ideas, and I think most of them, in terms of structure, are totally accepted and are the basis of what we are negotiating now. Of course, they're still negotiating about the precise numbers. But we came to Hong Kong without much hope, and I must say that that was the first time in which, just before Hong Kong, President Lula called for the first time Prime Minister Blair to see if a summit meeting could not take place even before Hong Kong, because we were thinking that maybe nothing would happen. But I say that if I look in retrospect, I think that Hong Kong, and it's appropriate that we are here in the Hong Kong Theater, I suppose. I don't know if the LSC did it on purpose or not, but in a way, we were able to make more advances than I had, less than were necessary, but more than I had hoped for. I mean, if I look, let us say, 1 year before, I say, well, I need much more. But if I look what I was expecting 1 month before Hong Kong, I think what we got in Hong Kong was rather reasonable in relation to what was possible to expect 1 month before Hong Kong. And I think, of course, I don't again want to go into detail, but the main illustration of that was a final date to eliminate export subsidies. And the final date, we wish it to be 2010, and then it was 2013. Fine, developing countries will lose some hundreds of millions of dollars, but I suppose that won't affect world history anyway, and so the maybe some of the farmers that received the money will continue receiving a little longer. But that was fine. We had an end date, finally, and that seemed impossible just before going to Hong Kong. And more than an end date, we had the recognition that a substantial part of these subsidies should be eliminated by 2010. There was a great resistance in accepting even a reference to the date of 2010, even as a kind of midterm, but it's now universally understood that the language that is in the text, which says substantial cuts by the mid-period, refer to 2010. And I even hear the European Commissioner referring to that date. So I think it's totally now acquired. It's a given. But we didn't make equivalent progress in the area of market access and domestic support. Some language, some literature, some grammar, as I heard the other day while I was discussing here. But grammar is always useful, but it's not enough. And we got a package for LDC. So that was also important because it showed that the international community is caring about the LDCs. But the main elements of the bargain were not there. And I hope in the next 5 minutes I can finish with that and explain what it means. What I mean by the main elements of the bargain. The main elements of the bargain involve, supposing, as I do suppose now, that the question of export subsidies is dealt with. So now it's a question of technical detail. There will be a lot of still trying to make things difficult, but I think this is solved. We have an end date, and we have even a mid date for a substantial reduction. So this is done. But we have the two other pillars of the agricultural negotiations, which is market access and domestic support. The European Union has gone some way in reducing, in proposing some reductions in domestic support, not as far as we would like, but has gone some way. The United States had not gone until October. Then they made an offer, which most of us have said was important but not sufficient. But certainly, in order to improve these offers, and especially the U.S. offer on domestic support, which is crucial for us, it's, for example, what affects our cotton. It's what may affect Uruguayan rice. It's also what may affect other countries' products, certainly the cotton for the poor African countries. But in order to go further on that, the U.S. is saying, I cannot speak for them, but I mean, it's my reading, is they say, well, okay, we may look at it, we may see if we can do some more, but we need market access. And of course, when you speak of market access, maybe their interests is more, it's broader than the European Union, but the European Union will be the standard. So if there is a low offer on the part of the European Union, then of course others who are either less developed or more vulnerable, or both, won't be able to do what is required by the U.S., so that they can do what we need in terms of their own domestic support. Well, so this is the central part of the agricultural bargain, but what are we told? We are told that, of course, in order for that to happen, there must be openings on the part of developing countries on NAMA, which is non-agricultural market access, and services. Well, let me tell you one thing about this. And I think this is very important to understand because when we read carefully the statement, I hope it can be found, certainly can be found in the website of our ministry, but also in the 10 Downing Street site. So I would recommend you to read, because I think this is one of the most important documents that have been adopted for a long time by two important leaders, because it's very concrete, very specific. Not specific in numbers, but in the general political thrust. So what is often said is that, well, developing countries should do more in their industrial tariffs, and they should do more in services. Well, of course, first there is a question of fairness and balance. I already said to you, for instance, the case of Brazil, maximum tariff 35, all tariffs bound, average applied tariff, it's about 11%. All the arguments, we cannot be penalized by unilateral liberalization. It would be a disincentive in the future for countries to liberalize further. But apart from fairness, there is a question of fact. What the kind of change that we need in agriculture will never have a tit-for-tat answer in industry and in services. We can't give. Not can't give because we don't want to give, but because what we did already in the Uruguay round goes such a long way in that direction that even, it will certainly not be the case, but even if countries like Brazil or India would accept to reduce the tariff to 0 or to 5 or to 10 maximum tariff, that would not be exactly the same of what we need to happen in agriculture. So we understand that from a political point of view, it is important that developing countries such as Brazil or others, do something, and we are prepared to do that, and that's what President Lula is saying here. But it has to have a proportionality. Actually, it has to have two kinds of proportionality. One proportionality is between agriculture and industry, because you cannot, a sector that has been lagging behind for such a long time cannot have the same treatment as another one that has been the object of progressive liberalization over the years. So it's one kind of proportionality. The second kind of proportionality, of course, is between developed and developing countries. How many people are employed in agriculture here in the UK? I mean, 1% of the working force, maybe 2%, never know exactly, because there are those, some people who don't live in the, in their property but still take some rent from it. But if you consider them, maybe it's 2%. How many people, so even if all these people would go to unemployment payment, they would not be a big burden. But in Brazil, in industry, you have 35% in industry. The same goes for India, I suppose. The same goes for Argentina, for other countries. So you can, Venezuela. So we cannot really put at the same level because the degree of sacrifice that's being demanded is not the same. Not at all. So this is something that one has to take into account. So we can't put, as if it were, the two at the same balance because it's not true. It's not fair. And factually impossible. But having said that, we are prepared to do our part. I would like to mention one or two things more and then maybe just make a brief reference to the document. There is another myth that is always mentioned. So what I want to say, it's not because of the lack of an ambitious offer on the parts of developing countries on industry or in services that the rich countries have not made their offer in agriculture. That's certainly not true. And I think now, because the document that President Lula and Prime Minister Blair signed yesterday, the bluff is called, because we are saying that we are prepared to do more. So let us see how people will respond to that. The other myth, and I referred to that in the beginning, is that, well, Brazil, Argentina, maybe other developing countries, they are looking only their own interests. They're not prepared. They used to say that in relation from us to India, they said the G20 won't last 2 months. And I have now it for 2 years. But now, because they can't go on saying that about Brazil and India or Brazil or Argentina and Egypt, because we have been there together. By the way, the G20 includes at least one, it includes five African countries, one of them being an LDC, which is Tanzania. But apart from that, they can no longer say that there is a division between the G20, which is not true, by the way, the big emerging countries, and the other poor countries, the G90, because there is a big gulf between them. Well, that's not true politically, and we were able to show in Hong Kong to have a common platform, including for elimination of subsidies, which of course is crucial, and it's not true economically. And one of the things that I liked, for instance, I participated recently again, coming back to Davos, in a round table in which several people were present, and the Minister of Ghana was there. And there was a comment by one of those present, you may guess whom, saying, well, you know, I think the developing countries in Africa actually don't have anything to gain from this ambitious package. Actually, they will only have to lose because they will lose preferences. There will be the preference erosion. I'm not saying that the preference erosion is not a problem, by the way, and we have to deal with that adequately. But and then it was very nice to listen from the because if I would respond, it would sound self-serving. But it was the trade minister of Ghana who said, no, no, maybe we're not competitive now, but if you abolish your subsidies and if you give greater market access, we will be competitive. And that's how these countries can, how should I say, overcome the legacy of colonialism, of being always dependent on two or three commodities to sell to Europe or to the United States or to whoever, and become really integrated in the world trade, not as a favor, not as a handout, but using their natural resources and their capacity, as we have done, for instance, recently in cotton. And we are very ready to help them legally or technically. We are just receiving a mission of Benin and some other, the four African countries. We also recently had a mission of SADC to Brazil because, as I said, that's part of, if I want to quote again from The Economist, Lula's view of the world. So, because all these may require some courage, moving from these established positions, we can, at this, and I come now to the final point, the status of the role. There are two ways of going. One is the incremental way. Well, that's what we have been doing, and see if the Europe can do a little more in market access, and then reduce maybe the number of sensitive products from 8% to whatever, improve a little bit the treatment for sensitive products. That's one way. The other way is to have really a political breakthrough. The incremental way has two sorts of problems. First, it won't give an ambitious result. Second, the price charged from us, developing countries, will be probably the same. Because even to pass through Congress an unambitious result, people will ask developing countries to do the kind of sacrifices that it's not easy for them to do. So that's why President Lula and Prime Minister Blair, in a very bold way, and I stress the boldness on both sides, because it's really not an easy an easy position to take, agreed on this document, and I, if you allow me, I'll just read maybe the central paragraph, because there's some paragraphs which have to do with the analysis. They say, we agreed today, that means yesterday, that we share a common view of the main elements of an ambitious pro-development outcome from the round. Current offers on the table fall far short of the deal we want. So it's not just incremental, they fall far short. So they have to be dramatically improved. We believe that all the main parties in the talks need to take bold steps to go beyond established negotiating positions to improve their offers on agricultural market access and domestic support, NAMA, and services. Those offers must also take account of the needs of developing countries by delivering improved market access in both agricultural and non-agricultural goods that is comparably high, but in a balanced and proportionate manner, consistent with the principle of the special and differential treatment. I think this is the crucial paragraph on what I was referring to as the main bargain. Then, of course, there is a very important reference to the treatment for LDCs, and we both subscribe to the idea that there must be 100% free access for LDCs, changes in rules of origin, and some other things. And then, of course, on the political process, there is also a very important reference to the need of a leaders' meeting, because we think that for the kind of we may be wrong, and if you're wrong, so much the better. And because the mere fact that we are speaking about the summit will help change the position of the negotiators, that's better. I mean, nobody wants to have the summit for the fun of it. Actually, it's for foreign ministers quite a burden, I must say. This mixture of protocol with substance is not always easy to manage. So, maybe a pleasant burden, but it's always a burden. So, in any way, if it can help even before that, fine. If not, then maybe at some time after April, probably a summit will have to be convened. And if others don't want to participate in the summit, it's for them to stand out and say, no, I don't want to have this round concluded. And they will have to accept that fact and have to accept that very huge responsibility. And I think President Lula, Prime Minister Blair, took an important leadership in the best sense of the world. When I say leadership is a very dangerous word, but I mean leadership by putting their faces out, so to say, in proposing this kind of breakthrough. So that's basically what I have to say. I thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here.
Thank you.
You from here? Fine.
Well, thank you very much, Ambassador. We now have some time for questions. There are microphones, mobile microphones, there are. So if you could put your hand up and I will get one delivered to you, and if you could say who you are, that would be very helpful. Yeah, I think the person with sort of half a beard I spotted first.
Hi, Tom Sharman from ActionAid. Minister, thanks very much for your talk. Could you say a little more about the proposed Leaders' Summit, and particularly, how will you ensure that all WTO members are represented there?
Sorry, the leaders that would be represented there.
Well, I think it, you know, this is a very tricky question because there is no group that is fully representative, because the only group that would be fully representative would be the one that would comprise the 150 odd members of the WTO. On the other hand, a group of 150 odd people would not be able to come to an agreement for the obvious reason that when the time comes that everybody has spoken, the meeting would be off. So we have to find something in between. I think you have to have some crucial developed countries, of course, some of the G7. I don't know if all of them of G8. I don't know if Russia will be already signed the accession agreement when we come to the meeting, but either G8 or G7, some of them, certainly. Some of the G20, certainly. But also some LDCs. I say, because I think this is crucial, because in order to have an agreement, of course, what I would like to say also is that, of course, if this meeting takes place, which I think, and both leaders think if it's necessary, it will not deal with all the details. It will deal with the driving forces. So I think a composition more or less along those lines, but how many, I don't know. But you have to have these different forces. You have to have G8, G20, and G90, if you wish.
Thank you. A woman sort of two rows in front there, and then I'll come over to this side. Yep.
Thank you very much for your talk. And it's a pleasure to have
you
here.
Can you give
you
your name?
Sorry?
Can you give your name?
Yeah, my name is Marcia Vieira Royal from Stephenson Harwood Law Firm in London. I'm here representing a law firm that has had many requirements from clients interested in actually investing in Brazil. And what is the best message for the companies that would be trying to tap that ground nowadays? Is there any plan in place to, say, reduce the tax burden in the companies that may be interested in actually open a branch or a subsidiary in Brazil? Are there plans to lift the stringent stringent links with the central government in terms of actually the regulations on the central bank, the part of the central bank? Is there any planning place actually to diminish the bureaucracy that one experiences to get to do business in Brazil nowadays?
Well, I can only say that, as you very clearly understand, I didn't come here to go into specific details in the regulations of each sector of activity. But I can only say that the Brazilian law firms that try to establish themselves in Europe find equal, if not more important and more difficult barriers. So this is something always to be negotiated and discussed. And as I said, I use your question maybe to put a more general point. There are many people that believe that we should unilaterally liberalize in every sector. There may be a point in one case or another to do that in order to gain competitiveness and so on. But you know, that's not what the old GATT or what the WTO is about. The WTO and the GATT are not about unilateral liberalization. They are about negotiation. And if anything, they don't go to liberalization through the David Ricardo way. Actually, what we want to reestablish it's incredible, but David Ricardo nowadays would be a revolutionary within the WTO, because, of course, it's precisely our competitive advantage that is not recognized. So what I'm trying to tell you is that in WTO, you practice trade liberalization through mercantilism. So that may sound contradictory, but it's what it happens. You liberalize because you want to have more of the other market. And in exchange, you have to give something. It's only the naive, only those that have been, formed maybe under ideologies that no longer hold, such as the Washington Consensus, I would say, that believe that unilateral liberalization can bring all the advantage. We don't believe that. We believe in liberalizing, but we believe in liberalizing through negotiations. That will apply to the sector of legal activities, law firms, but also apply to cotton. So if there is a good deal, a nice deal, maybe your preoccupations could be seen in the cotton.
Person on the Christopher Roberts on the third row there. Yeah. And then I'll go to the back.
Christopher Roberts from the European Services Forum, representing service industries across the European Union, who are certainly keen on an ambitious Doha outcome. Would Minister Amrim agree that it's in the interests of countries at pretty well any stage of development to have access to modern services like financial services, telecoms, computer services, and so on, that they will reinforce their chances for getting access to those services, which are often not available locally in poorer countries, if they take commitments under the GATS in the Doha round and get all the investment, the extra skills, technology transfer which flows from that?
Well, I think in a way it's a similar answer, and we don't have access to those services. I don't know which countries you're talking about, but in Brazil, certainly we do have. And actually, I tell a story. There was a Brazilian who once came here, saw the HSBC, and said, well, the HSBC also exists here, because he thought it was a Brazilian bank. So so much for the access to markets in the financial services area. Telecommunications also. I mean, most companies are foreign companies. There are areas which are still have phase one or two restrictions, I would agree, and some of them may be negotiated. Some of them, which are constitutionally based, nobody could expect them to renegotiate in a round like that. But I think there's a lot that can be done, and that we are doing. Actually, Brazil is the country that has offered, it was the second country in offering, the second biggest offer in number of sectors in services, the first being India in this round. And we are participating in many other areas. But I would like to complement that with another thing, and I would like to say it publicly. I'll be saying it privately, but I say it publicly. There are things that are not for negotiation. Education, health, they are not for negotiation. We don't see them as business. We see them as public services. That doesn't prevent that sometimes you can do and combine the two things. But then we have to do it in ad hoc basis, examining each case in its own merit, not, let us say, as a general obligation that would, I don't know what would people think if Cambridge or Oxford would be for sale for some international business, not to speak of
that. They're not worth a lot, so don't worry about that. They're loss making. The woman in the blue jumper, that's it. Wait for the microphone, is on its way to you.
Sorry. Anna Dixon from the International Development Committee. I agree with Mr. Amarin that we need more than an incremental approach. An incremental approach will not lead to a development outcome. A political breakthrough is needed, but I think you're talking to the wrong person. I think that Britain had its best chance of influencing the outcome of the round in 2005, and it didn't manage to do that. So I think you should be talking to Peter Mandelson and not to Tony Blair. And do you have any options, any opportunities to have such an agreement with Peter Mandelson? Because if not, then the breakthrough is not going to happen.
I talk a lot to Peter Mandelson, by the way. And I hear a lot from him, both directly and through the media. So there is no lack of dialogue in that part. I won't go into the political personal links between Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson. It's not my sphere of competence, certainly. But I think that Tony Blair, being the Prime Minister of the UK, is an important leader. Whether he's in the chairman of the European Union or not, UK is a major force. We know, and he knows, and everybody knows that we need to influence others in different ways. You won't expect me to reveal my roadmap totally here, because it's a complex roadmap, by the way, and it has to be adapted. But we cannot miss an opportunity to show that an important leader of the developing world like Lula and an important leader of the developed world like Tony Blair have a very close, if not identical, view on what is needed to have a breakthrough in the round. Whether others will pick that up or not, I have a great respect for Peter Mandelson. I mean, he's a very intelligent man, a very able negotiator, and as you say, is the proper person to talk. That's the person I talk to, not Lula. Lula talks to Tony Blair. I talk to Peter Mandelson. But we know also that he, as myself and others, have his limitations. He has 25 bosses, I understand. So it's difficult. So we have to convince him, but we have to convince some of his influential bosses as well.
It's nice to hear our Prime Minister still worth talking to. It makes us feel better. That's the third row. Third man in third row, did you have a question? You did. Okay. One here. With a moustache this time. I'm being very even-handed as far as facial hair is concerned, right?
Sofian Jussou from the World Trade Institute in Bern, Switzerland. I would like to ask about this agriculture and biotechnology, because what happened is, even if we have reached an agreement to reduce subsidies, but there's a huge disparity between agriculture technology in the developing countries and developed countries. So there must be transfer of technologies between the developed countries to the developing and LDCs, because if the technology remains the same, even if subsidies are reduced, then the price disparity will remain, because the LDCs and developing countries will use the old technology, whereas the developing countries will use new technologies which help them to reduce and compete in the environment. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Having worked myself in the Ministry of Science and Technology, I'm all in favor of transfer of technology, and more in favor even local research that will enable progress in technology. And I'm very much in favor also of South-South cooperation for developing technology, which sometimes is more appropriate because it's more in accordance to the needs and the capacities of the country. But having said that, we cannot look at agriculture today only, and I think you understand that, that's why you're asking this question, as primary products. There is a lot of technology in it. But I think it's not beyond the possibilities of the developing countries. I mean, if you take the Brazilian case in ethanol, for instance, I think we have the highest technology available. And also the technology of the, I see the representative here of the car industry, and also the car industry had to adapt its own technology, and all that was done in Brazil without foreign sources of finance. Of course, countries are different, and of course, Brazil is a huge market, and India maybe can follow the same route, or China, but maybe for a small country would be difficult. But that's why we, as Brazil, have been working with African countries and also CARICOM countries to transfer our technology. We are already having two dehydrating plants in a joint venture manner in Jamaica. And I think it would be a challenge, I mean, since we are in the UK, for Brazilian and maybe joint UK-Brazilian companies to go to some African countries which have lots of natural resource and plant sugarcane also, and why not? And then you adapt also the car engine, if necessary, because up to 10% of ethanol, you don't need any adaptation, really, and move on. I mean, I give the example of ethanol. I could give other examples. We are now receiving, as I said, this delegation, which is Benin, Burkina Faso, Mali, and no, not Botswana. No, Mali and Burkina Faso. I said Burkina Faso, didn't I? Anyway, they're four countries. But anyway, they're coming to Brazil precisely to study, among other things, there is the commercial part, but also the technological part, and even the different qualities of cotton that we are growing. And we are quite happy to share that technology with countries that need more than ourselves. And I think a lot has to be done. I would like just to stress one thing. I think people talk a lot about aid to trade. I mean, it became a fashionable subject nowadays for LDCs and other poor countries. And I think you are right. A lot of the aid to trade, if you ever get that money from the World Bank, should be directed not to Brazil, I might dare say not to Venezuela or Uruguay, but it should go to really poorer countries that can then go to research. to reinforce their capacity to have value added within their own products.
We're running a bit short of time. I had Professor Wade, the bald one.
You have two professors. I didn't hear that. I was actually quite worried by what you said, and the reason for the worry is because you seem to be accepting the basic structure of the negotiations, which, as you made clear, is developed countries are to give better access to developing countries for their agricultural exports, and in return, developing countries are to give better access to developed countries for industry and services. And what I wanted to ask you is whether you think that there is scope for bringing into the negotiations revising some of the Uruguay round agreements, such as TRIMS and TRIPS and GATS and several others, which seriously constrains the policy space of developing countries to pursue a range of industrial policies which have been proven to be effective in developing domestic industries, and which these agreements seem to take off the table, locking developing countries into agriculture and raw materials-based industries. If that is the case, it's extremely worrying.
Well, let me first say that. I would agree with the general philosophy behind your question. The question is, and that's why we have been emphasizing so much the question of proportionality. And I was very clear in saying that first it would be unfair, but even if it were not unfair, and even if we wished, there's no way that we could give something equivalent to what we need in agriculture, for the simple reason that we have given already in the Uruguay round. You're quite right about that. But I don't know how familiar you are with the negotiations now, but you'll see that in the case of TRIMS, Brazil, I think together with India, made a proposal precisely to give more flexibility and more policy space to developing countries. By a kind of silent conspiracy, I might say, maybe even an unintended one to some extent, it has not been easy to move that along, because that was part of the implementation issues. And implementation issues were, although they were originally meant to address questions of primary interest of developing countries, somehow, without nobody noticing, even myself, I was in Doha because I didn't notice that, because it was so absurd, the question of GIs got together with the implementation issues. And now there is a blockage to look at some of these implementation issues because, of course, the US and others don't want to look at GIs, and the European Union, of course, uses the fact that it is together with developing countries' demands in order to force it. And I think it would be only fair, if we could. I'm not saying that we should not deal with GIs. Actually, I do believe that in the end, the calling or the vocation of European agriculture is to produce Camembert cheese or what you have it. I don't know in England how much you have it. Cheddar cheese, maybe, or some sort of Umbria olive oil, things like that. That's what they should do, because that's what they can do better than we do. And forget about oil seeds, forget about wheat and all that, because all that they do at a cost for the taxpayer and the consumer in Europe and to the detriment of the developing countries. So I agree with your points. We have been trying to fight with that, and it would be very good if the public opinion in this country and beyond would make that point, because precisely on TRIMS we have a proposal. On the other question that you mentioned, which is TRIPS, actually the biggest advance that we had was in Doha itself in relation to the medicaments, and it was consolidated later. Well, maybe it's not the ideal agreement, but I think it's something that is being used in Brazil. We never issued a compulsory license, but the simple fact that it is there allows us to have a better negotiation with the pharmaceutical companies. And it can allow even for South-South trade, which is helpful. It's still in the area of TRIPS. We have a proposal on TRIPS and biodiversity, which is still being discussed. And in relation to the GATS as such, things change in time. When the GATS was approved, I actually thought it was really quite a burden for us. Now I think it's, when I have to see other negotiations, and I go to the FTAA negotiations, the ALCA in South America, in Latin America with the United States, or the negotiations with the European Union, actually, the GATS became a good security blanket, because the architecture of the GATS, as it goes, it's rather development friendly. That's different from the other things that people want to have now, which go much further. So I agree, let us say, with your general philosophical point, and I think I share your basic view, but I think that we are doing what we can. And you're quite right, we can never expect that we'll do in industry and services something that has an equal economic value to what we expect in agriculture. Otherwise, it would not be a development problem. That would be an underdevelopment problem, and we don't want that.
Thank you. We're running out of time. I'm going to take one more question from the back, and then we're going to leave it to the press for a few minutes. Yeah, there, woman at the back in black.
Hi, good morning. My name is Raquel Batista from the Indian Consulate in Minas Gerais, and also a mastering student here in LSE. I would like, my question is more related to the G20 and the Brazil and Indian relationship. A lot of political analysts, they see that India and Brazil, they are more, they can be considered partners at the multilateral levels, but however, at bilateral level, they are can be seen much more as competitive partners, mainly in what regards agriculture. So bearing that in mind, I would like you to share your views on the Mercosur and India agreement signed last year in July. Thank you.
I understand you are a Brazilian who works in the Indian Consulate General in Minas Gerais, and you are studying in LSE, right? So that's globalization. I can't go into all the detail because it would take too long, but I think that the Mercosur-India agreement is a very important one. We are really even trying to expand that to a kind of IPSA, trilateral agreement, South-South, including South Africa. We also have an agreement with South Africa. But that demands a change of culture. And, I think to a large extent in Brazil we were able to do that. And I think when President Lula spoke more about South-South trade and changing the world trade geography, he did not only say that, he practiced that. And that's why he visited 17 African countries, he visited 5 Arab countries, he visited India, he visited China. And of course, he visited also the UK 2 or 3 times and visited Spain and other countries. So it's not that we want to abandon the North, but we want also to concentrate on the South. But it takes time to make this kind of Copernican revolution, if you wish, in your mindset. And I have quite a trouble to attract my good friend Kamal Nath to Brazil. I hope that through your channels, you can see how important it is for him to come to Brazil so that we can develop further our agreements. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, look, the Minister has been very kind with his time. He's gone on longer than we had originally suggested, but there is now going to be a little press conference in here. So I'd ask all the very kind and polite people to leave, leaving the press. It's usually easy to tell the difference. So thank you very much for coming, Minister, and thank you for your time.